Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve is going to make a big, big policy announcement tomorrow. We will tell you what that announcement's going to be in about, a minute and a half or so. Also on the broadcast today, Michael Lewis on Liar's Poker 25 years on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 28th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The macroeconomic news of this Tuesday and actually of tomorrow, Wednesday, as well, centers on the proceedings of the Federal Open Market Committee. Janet Yellen and the gang are meeting today and tomorrow, and it is perhaps the worst-kept secret in the global economy that the Fed is going to announce the end of its big bond-buying program, quantitative easing, which has been going on these past 6 years. A word of caution, though, as the rest of the business media catches up to us. Don't believe those headlines saying the Fed has ended its stimulus. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains now from New York.
Quantitative easing. It's fun and accessible, and all the cool kids are talking about it, right?
Believe it or not, I tend to try not to talk about quantitative easing at cocktail parties, but just the real brief explanation is that it's a way for the Fed to increase the money supply by buying bonds.
Ann Owen is an economics professor at Hamilton College. She says ending QE may sound dramatic, but it's actually a relatively modest move because the Fed now has a nice, fat balance sheet worth over $4 trillion.
That's money that's in the banking system and hopefully will find its way into the economy.
Michelle Girard is the chief U.S. economist with RBS.
As long as those reserves aren't taken back out through asset sales or other methods of shrinking the balance sheet, then the reserves that have already been created are still able to boost economic growth.
Think of the Fed as a jogger who's not slowing down or speeding up, but keeping the same pace. And there's a long road ahead. The economy is clearly in a better place than it was when QE started, but Morris Davis, a former economist at the Federal Reserve Board, is skeptical about how much of that is due to QE.
We can debate its effectiveness, and we should debate its effectiveness, but going forward, we're going to see a lot more of this, actually, by central banks all around the world. And I think we'll point back to this episode as having led the path.
After QE, the Fed still has its more traditional tool, interest rates. Davis says it'll probably be a while before the Fed feels comfortable enough to start raising them in any meaningful way. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This week has been, to very loosely paraphrase Charles Dickens, a tale of two social media companies. Twitter reported profits yesterday. Revenue was up from last year, and yet shares were off almost 10% today over fears that its user base isn't growing fast enough. Today, then, after the bell, came Facebook, which seems to have finally cracked the code on making money from mobile ads. So, Marketplace's David Weinberg brings us this tale of two networks.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of metrics.
If you're a social network, the two most important metrics for you are your user base and your level of engagement of the users.
Analyst Shyam Patil says the value that Wall Street places on a social network like Twitter or Facebook is primarily based on its MAUs, monthly active users. The more active users, the more potential for ad revenue. This is why Twitter's stock took a hit today. Investors were disappointed in the growth rate of Twitter's MAUs, which is about one-fifth Facebook's. But Nathan Eagle, the CEO of Jhana, a mobile marketing platform, is skeptical of the one-metric-fits-all approach.
I see Twitter and Facebook as fundamentally, you know, they have different models and they're going after different things.
Twitter, for example, doesn't just sell ads. It has a whole suite of developer tools that it sells to companies, tools for detecting crashes and monetizing. These are parts of Twitter's business model that aren't represented in the MAU number. As a result, Nathan Eagle thinks Twitter should have its own more nuanced metric for assessing its value.
So MAUs are at least a proxy for, you know, success. But I do think that we'll probably come up with a bit more nuanced metrics.
But until that more nuanced metric arrives, the almighty MAU will likely reign supreme. Or as Dickens said, Twitter and Facebook will continue to live for good or evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Can't top that, right? Wall Street today, pretty good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a traffic jam in Los Angeles right now, and while that statement might well be valid whenever you happen to be listening to this program, I am not, in fact, talking about cars on freeways. The Los Angeles Long Beach Port Complex, the busiest in the country, is so backed up right now that some importers are avoiding it altogether. Problems there are delaying subshipments for 2 weeks or more. And as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports, unlike Las Vegas, what happens at Southern California ports does not stay in Southern California.
Outside the gates at the Port of Long Beach, trucks idle in a line as far as the eye can see. They're waiting to pick up shipping containers filled with clothes, shoes, electronics, you name it, says port spokesman Lee Peterson.
A lot of the cargo going on right now is the import for the holiday shopping season.
But at this point, there's a traffic jam.
At this point, we are experiencing congestion issues.
And congestion here means trouble for the nation's retail economy. Southern California's twin ports handle 40% of U.S. imports, and October is a critical month, says supply chain advisor Frank Leo.
If people are planning on having it stocked for the Christmas holiday, you know, it needs to be in the port now. It needs to be moving through. So any delays now are kind of critical. You know, we're running out of runway at this point.
The delays hurt Asian suppliers, too. They routinely sign contracts that allow U.S. retailers to reject late shipments or buy them at discount. Port officials say the root cause of the delays here is a shortage of trailer chassis to haul cargo away. But that problem has been exacerbated by an unexpected surge in imports this year, unresolved labor issues, and the rapid rise of mega ships. They can carry three times as many containers as older ships, and they're straining capacity.
So you've got a really complex logistical nightmare to solve.
Jock O'Connell at Beacon Economics says the delays have given Southern California ports a black eye. Some of their customers are diverting goods to other ports. Jonathan Gold is at the National Retail Federation.
Canada, Pacific Northwest, East Coast, Gulf Coast, kind of wherever they can find space to be able to bring that product in.
A few retailers are even flying their merchandise into the U.S., even though it's much pricier. Noel Hasegaba, chief commercial officer at the Long Beach Port, says they've cut some shipper fees and are working with chassis suppliers to try and relieve the bottleneck.
At the end of the day, our reputation is at stake. Beneficial cargo owners have choices, and we are doing everything that we can to make sure that we continue to be the gateway of choice.
A gateway that, along with the L.A. port, handles $400 billion worth of goods in a single year. In Long Beach, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This is our 25th anniversary year. 1989, Marketplace went on the air. Lots has changed since then, of course, in business and in the economy and on Wall Street as well. If you were looking for a book about the financial industry back then, you couldn't do much better than to pick up a copy of Liar's Poker, also published in 1989 and reissued this year. It is, of course, Michael Lewis's memoir and indictment of the business that he was a small part of back then, selling bonds for Salomon Brothers out of London in the mid-1980s. It has been called, Liar's Poker has, the definitive book of its time. Michael, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
This book was not received the way you thought it was going to be received, right? You had thought it would be a cautionary tale, and yet 6 months later, you're getting all these letters from college kids saying, how do I do what you did?
It had the opposite effect, the one I expected. I didn't think of it as a moralistic tale about Wall Street, but I did think, you know, I was there at the beginning when all these kids like me were rolling onto the street because they couldn't think of what else to do with their lives. And I did think that for someone who had some other idea of what to do with their lives, it would demystify it and they could go on and do what they were supposed to do. And instead, I swear, after 6 months, I had 1,000 letters from kids saying, I'm a junior at Ohio State and I've read your how-to book about how to get ahead on Wall Street. Is there anything you left out because you've made me even more interested in doing it?
But, well, and you know why, right? It's because you talk about making money come out of a telephone.
Not only do I make money coming out of a telephone, but I clearly have no idea what I'm doing.
So the combination
is it's like catnip for a male in college because he has no idea what he can do. He has no sense of himself in the marketplace. And then there's this thing you can go. They just throw you, give you lots of money, even though you don't know what you're doing. It created a stampede.
And you say male intentionally because at the time this book was written, females in this business were few and very far between.
True. I would say that even now, they're kept far from the risk-taking. It's still a very male-dominated business. But at the time, yes, my training program at Salomon Brothers was, I don't know, 85%, 90% guys.
Yeah, and very fraternity house-like. I mean, the description of some of those guys sitting in the back row of that training class, throwing the spitballs and all that jazz.
It was considered normal and acceptable to order a stripper up on the trading floor.
This is probably not the time to admit this, nor the person to admit it to, but I had not actually read this book until we booked this interview.
It doesn't really hurt my feelings.
Well, all right. Well, good. I'm glad you're over that. But what struck me is really how little seems to have changed. I mean, the faces are different, and maybe the modus operandi is different, but the essence of what happens on Wall Street 25 years later seems sort of to be the same.
There's a timelessness about it, isn't there? I'd say, there are a couple of things that I think are a little different, but it's by degree, not kind. I think that the street has gotten much, much better at disguising what it does because it's gotten so much more complicated. All of a sudden, you're looking at a truly opaque black box when you're looking at something that used to be as simple as the stock market. The other thing is this idea of too big to fail. I mean, that did not exist when I wrote the book. There was a sense that even my firm, Salomon Brothers, could fail. And now, if you're in the equivalent of Salomon Brothers today, you're in a place that basically you sense won't be allowed to fail.
You say, actually, that these guys are working harder at establishing a public persona. But I wonder if that doesn't lend itself to a real difference, actually, between Wall Street then and now. Wall Street then was sleazy, right? They're having strippers on the trading floor, as you said. Now it just seems a little sinister because we're supposed to believe that they're out for the common good.
I think there has been much more attention paid to how things seem rather than how things are than there was then. They're phalanxes of corporate PR people. People inside these firms, no way they're going to talk to a journalist kind of thing.
Yeah.
You got a much slicker corporate exterior now and a much more careful presentation of self. And one of the things that was kind of lovely about the world I described in Salomon Brothers is in the 80s is that the people kind of were how they seemed. There wasn't a lot of hypocrisy. And you might approve or disapprove of the gambling or the strippers on the trading floor, but there was a certain integrity to it.
And what is it now then? What is Wall Street now?
Lost. It has a very unclear sense of its purpose in the world. And I think that's because technology has created a world that's very hostile to intermediaries in most industries, and Wall Street has fought to preserve its position as an intermediary, which is really not necessary in a lot of cases. It's sort of like clawing to preserve its revenues and its profits at a time when it actually probably is in decline.
Do you reread your own writing at all? Have you read this
book?
It's
funny you ask that because I got on the plane when I was coming to New York the other day. I thought, I really ought to reread this thing. I've never reread it. And I opened it and I thought, I'm so bored with myself. I can't do this. I just can't. And I tell you, the only other time I'd done this is I'd put it on my lap when the paperback came out in 1990 to reread it before I went on my paperback book tour. And the guy in the seat next to me saw it and he said, "Oh, I read that book, cynical bastard."
And
so I put it away then and I didn't read it then. So I have not actually reread it, but I vaguely remember what happened to me.
It is a book called Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, out 25 years ago this year. Michael, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up,
it's really easy to scare one person. When you have to scare 10,000 people or 20,000 people, that gets very hard.
People paying to be scared. I am just never going to get that. Never, ever. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 187 points today, 1.1%, 17,005. The NASDAQ climbed 78 points, 1.75%, closed at 4,564. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 1.1% there as well, 1,985 the number. All right, what do you get if you're a mining company with stakes in copper and gold and just lately oil as well? Well, for Freeport MacMoran, the biggest miner in the United States, a one-third fall off in earnings is what you get. Shares in the pits as well, down 4.1%. One sign the housing recovery is real. Sales of Whirlpool appliances are up. Whirlpool surged 6.75% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Game maker Nintendo is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. October 29th is the anniversary of Black Tuesday, a devastating day for Wall Street in 1929. And pick up a little something extra special for that special someone, your cat. Tomorrow is National Cat Day. And get something for yourself, too, a lint brush. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Researchers at Northeastern University have this advice for the early holiday shoppers among you. The price you see online for a given item might not be the same as the price I see. You or I might be charged more or less, depending on what kind of device you're using, a desktop computer, say, or an Android phone, or whether you are logged into that company's website. All right, so that's the bad news. The worst news is that it's really, really hard to tell what might get you the best price. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Other reports had documented individual quirks. Staples might charge you $1.50 more for a stapler, depending on your zip code. The CEO of Orbitz once acknowledged steering Mac users to fancier hotels. This study was more rigorous, and it found systematic differences in which users see what products at what prices. And the systems would be super hard for consumers to game. Northeastern professor Christo Wilson is a co-author on the study.
Initially, we assumed that the best thing was just going to be clear your cookies. But it turns out that it's much more nuanced than that.
Clearing your cookies gets you slightly more random results on Expedia. Android customers see higher-priced items when they search HomeDepot.com, and sometimes the same items at a higher price. Travelocity seems to offer better deals to iPhone users. That's called price discrimination, which sounds bad, but in general is actually really popular.
This happens all the time in the real world. People get discounts, there's coupons. People love it. But it's typically transparent.
You know when there's an early bird special or a discount for using a loyalty card. The price is right there on the shelf or in an ad or on the menu. Online, not so much. Ryan Kahlo is a law professor at the University of Washington.
One of the problems with the capability of a company to personalize the terms upon which it offers you services and the price is the fact that there's this great information asymmetry. You don't know when they're doing it.
Christo Wilson from Northeastern thinks maybe this kind of thing should be regulated, but if it's so hard to detect, how would those regulations even be enforced? In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of young entrepreneurs comes this next story. Alex Schlaferman was 16 years old when he founded his company, Vante Toys. 5 years later, he is 21. The company is worth millions of dollars. He owns a factory in China, and their latest product, something called Wallet Ninja, is going to be on Amazon and on store shelves just in time for the holidays. Alex, thanks for coming on.
How's it going?
It's going well. Tell me about your company. You just bought a factory in China?
We have a factory in China. I've had the factory for a couple of years, actually. The reason why we bought the factory is because we realized that, you know, the same amount we were paying to other manufacturers, was that price difference could have paid for all of our own equipment, all of our own salaries. So we decided to just make the move and purchase our own place.
Tell me how you go from a kid in New York City, because once again, you're like 21 years old, right?
Just turned 21.
Tell me how you go about buying a factory in China. How does that happen?
You know, looking back, it's all like one big blur. But I started working with a guy who had a toy business. And I actually ended up buying my products from a company in China. Uh-huh. And one of the guys that I was buying from, he was just working there. But he ended up quitting one day. And I just stayed in touch with him. And I said, listen, one day I want to open up my own place. Eventually, I was able to pick him up, and he moved like 2,000 miles, left his family to come start my entire operation in China, and he's running it over there right now.
How did you start this thing? On your mom and dad's credit card or your own bootstrap? I mean, you know, obviously you're plowing your profits back into your thing to grow, but how'd you get going?
I've been in, you know, consumer goods kind of my whole life. I started out selling kitchen gadgets at state fairs when I was like in eighth grade, just going around the country selling kitchen gadgets. You know, I saved up like 30 grand, but anyone who's been in business knows that you could blow through 30 grand. You know, it's like water in the sink. And then, you know, you run out of money and then you're like, crap, what can I do? Then, you know, I had to steal some of my parents' credit cards. They didn't even have that, you know, those big of limits, but I was just kind of like, I had a terminal in my bedroom. I had a terminal. So I was charging these cards like $10,000 just so I could get cash into my bank account so I could do something with it. And then I'm like, I'll deal with it later. You know,
How did that work out?
I mean, listen, at the time, you know, I knew I would get a lot of headache for it, and I knew there would be a lot of fights over it, but it was just something that I felt like I needed to do.
You're square now with your parents, right? You paid them back?
Oh, I'm definitely square
All right,
with them.
Just checking.
More than square, yeah.
What is, if you had to put it into a word or two, what's your brand, right? I mean, what is it that Vontae Toys is?
Vontae Toys itself isn't a brand. I don't think having Vontae in a product really means anything at this point. Because my specialty is products that are under like $20. That's what I'm good at. I don't understand like luxury goods or high-end fashion. I don't understand anything like that. One day I hope that it will be where we're making a certain type of thing. But at this point, it's just we're working on products of all kind and seeing what makes sense. So we make multiple brands.
And you're just throwing it all against the wall and you're seeing what sticks.
Hopefully with a little bit more professionalism than that, but in the rawest sense, we're still trying to figure out what it is that we're good at. Hmm.
Alex Schlaferman, his company is called Vontae Toys. Alex, thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We spent, as a society, as an economy, according to the National Retail Federation, $6.9 billion on Halloween last year. It'll top seven this year because all those pumpkins and costumes and bags of candy add up, you know. Also on the list of Halloween-related expenditures are haunted houses. Lauren Silverman of KERA in Dallas took a tour of one to find out what makes a successful scare.
At the entrance to Dark Hour Haunted House, an animatronic witch stirs a steaming cauldron. Artistic director Alan Hopps says Halloween is a business and an art.
It's really easy to scare one person. When you have to scare 10,000 people or 20,000 people, that gets very hard.
Halloween is the second largest commercial holiday in the U.S., and competition among hauntrepreneurs is fierce. To draw in crowds, Hopps has to get creative, go beyond the standard themes of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Haunted houses will always have a redneck, inbred, cannibal theme. That's the easiest and cheapest one to do because all your costumes are thrift stores, all of your makeup is blood and dirt, and you're covered.
So instead of doing the expected, Dark Hour sends you through tunnels that spin and past witches singing eerie opera. If a group of witches owned a haunted mansion, you're inside, and there's no escape. In one room, a giant man wearing a bloody butcher's apron shuffles toward you. There's a feast on the table, and below the grapes and meat, a woman pleads for help. Hop says people love to be spooked because it's a release. He says adults used to have real beasts to fear. Lions, tigers, and bears. Many of today's fears are less tangible.
It's traffic and mortgage and taxes and all of the stuff that stress people out that aren't even real things. So we come in, and as haunted house actors, we put a face on it. You can peg whatever fear you have on us and scream it away.
Scaring people has become a global industry.
Larry Kirchner builds terror attractions across the globe, including Creepy World, the largest haunted adventure in the Midwest. A good year, his creations bring in around $4 to $5 million. Kirchner designed his first haunted house in fourth grade. Back then, cold spaghetti for guts and peeled grapes for eyeballs would do. Today, he says there are high-tech ghost tours, paintball zombie attacks, even extreme haunts where actors tie you up and pretend to torture you.
Halloween used to be this holiday where people would carve a pumpkin, watch a horror movie, and go trick-or-treating, and now you've got everybody trying to exploit it.
In the past, a 10-minute adventure was just fine. Visitors today expect a haunted house to be a full evening's entertainment. At Dark Hour in Texas, the maze takes nearly 40 minutes to walk through. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is either a comment on the sorry state of American journalism or on the avarice of iconic commercial property holders in Manhattan, or maybe both, I don't know. CNN announced its election night plans today, including this passage, which has been edited for clarity, I should tell you. Here begins the quote, CNN will take over the Empire State Building to display U.S. Senate vote results. As results are projected, a vertical LED illuminated meter on top the spire of the building will ascend in either red or blue. Once a color, red or blue, reaches the top of the spire, that party will take control of the Senate. So, if I read that right, what? CNN gets to decide? And how much do you suppose they paid for that, too? All right, that's it. We're done. The Dow up 187 points today, about 1.1%. The NASDAQ up 78 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 bumped itself 23 points higher, also 1%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.